From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Our state has a new health and welfare director. Alex Adam faces a growing Medicaid budget and has already cut some vacant positions. And on day one, he made adoption a top priority, saying he wants to double the amount of foster families in Idaho. After past struggles with Idaho lawmakers over federal funding and the department pulling out of the Boise Pride Parade 2 years ago, health and welfare has weathered some controversy. So, how will he work to heal relationships in the Idaho legislature and in the community? Director Adams is here today for the hour to talk about his new role in health and welfare. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Glad to be here.
So, Director Adams, can we just talk a little bit about your background first? How did you get to health and welfare?
Well, Jim, I've been in state government since 2015. I started as the executive director of the Board of Pharmacy, and then went from there to running the state Division of Financial Management, which is really just a fancy way of saying the state budget shop. So for the last 5.5 years, I've worked directly with Governor Little, developing the budget, working with the legislature and getting critical programs funded. And then about 5 weeks ago, made the jump from the budget shop to the Department of Health and Welfare. So nearly a decade in public service and state government, learned everything from how to work with the legislature, how to work with the stakeholder community, how to run a budget. And hopefully that Venn diagram of skills will serve me well in this new role as well.
And on your very first day on the job, Director, you said you were making adoption your top priority. In fact, you signed a temporary rule to waive all adoption fees. You also said your goal is to double the number of foster families in Idaho. And I want to talk a little bit more about that because, as you are well aware, we do not have enough foster families in Idaho. So can you talk about your new foster parent Bill of Rights and really why you're so passionate about helping these foster kids find parents?
Yeah, I started the conversation with the governor about this Department of Health and Welfare role a couple months back. And in planning, it gave me time to think through where can we make the biggest bang for our buck and where can we get the longest term ROI. And I don't think there's anyone that doubts that child welfare outcomes is where you can make the most long-term return on investment. So in talking it through with the governor, he felt that was consistent with his goal, which is to make Idaho the place where all can have the opportunity to thrive and where our children and grandchildren choose to stay and those who have left choose to return. So focusing on child welfare specifically kind of became the nexus in the conversations I was having with the governor's office about how to focus the agency. Mm-hmm. As you kind of noted in your intro, I mean, the Department of Health and Welfare is a large agency. There's 3,000 folks. There's 40 field offices. It runs hospitals, intermediate care facilities. It regulates public swimming pools. It repatriates citizens back to the United States, into the state of Idaho. And, anytime you have an organization of that size and with that sort of reach, if you try to do everything, you're not going to accomplish anything. And then the inverse is also true. The more you sharpen your focus, the more you can spend your disproportionate time and energy on that topic, and the more you can make a difference on that topic. And, again, in conversations with the governor's office, we felt like child welfare was that area to really hyper-focus on and make a meaningful difference on.
Mm-hmm. And when you took this role, going into it, I mean, were you aware of just how dire the situation is when it comes to the lack of foster families? I mean, we've heard stories of certain foster children, having to stay in Airbnbs. I mean, things like that, because we just don't have enough families.
So the legislature has done a really nice job of having oversight of this topic. And the legislature's Office of Performance Evaluation has published a handful of reports, going back 5+ years now, about the challenges in the system and the opportunities in the system. And then earlier this spring, the legislature hosted an oversight committee on child welfare. So to kind of orient myself for the role, I read every word, every page of those OPE reports, and I went back and listened to every minute of the legislative oversight hearing. And I got to tell you that the stories I heard were gut-wrenching of foster families who were trying to make a difference, who were trying to make an impact in the lives of children, but for one reason or another had bad experiences with the system. And certainly the system is much larger than the Department of Health and Welfare. It includes the courts, it includes guardian ad litems, it includes biological parents, foster families, department staff, and others. So I certainly had a flavor of what the challenges are. I think until you roll up your sleeves and look under the hood, you know, you don't fully appreciate all of the challenges in front of you. So heading into the role, I went out and sat with the intake team who takes calls related to child abuse. I got out with a safety assessor. I got out with a caseworker to see these things in the field. And it was the totality of those things that told me we didn't have time to waste. I didn't have time to spend 9 months studying the issue, groping around and figuring out what I was going to do. I decided we needed to make some big changes quickly. I focused pretty heavily on staff and getting the right staff on the bus. So I brought in a new deputy director overseeing child, youth, and family services. The gentleman they brought in, it's Monty Pro. Monty might be familiar to some of your listeners. He used to be a cabinet level director for juvenile corrections, and his goal at juvenile corrections was to eliminate the need for the Department of Juvenile Corrections because they were so effective at preventing children entering the system. And I needed people with that mindset around me. The other person I brought in was Jean Fisher. Jean might also be a familiar name. She spent 33 years as a deputy prosecutor for Ada County on child welfare cases specifically. And her legal background, her deep subject matter expertise, and kind of the no-nonsense approach certainly was appealing to me. So I focused heavily on getting the staffing right, getting the team around me that I thought could effectuate change and make a meaningful difference. And then certainly want to get the policy right too. You hinted at some of the things we did on day one. We waived adoption fees on day two. You know, we slashed some of the unnecessary regulations that were impeding foster families getting licensed quickly. Now, just one example, we used to have a rule that said, foster family that applies, we would initiate action on that within 30 days. I personally thought we should initiate action within 30 seconds. And so I changed that rule to make it as quick and easy as possible for the right foster families to sign up. That doesn't mean we're going to cut corners. That doesn't mean we're not going to do criminal background checks and registry checks and home studies and other things to make sure that these will be suitable homes for children. But we're not going to let red tape get in the way of otherwise suitable families from being able to make a difference in the lives of these children. So I'll be crystal clear. Not one of those things I mentioned is going to solve the issue. Staffing will nudge us in the right direction. Some policy changes will nudge us in the right direction. But this is going to take a culture change at the department. And you hinted on, you know, kind of the hallmark of our culture change to date, which is the Foster Parent Bill of Rights. What that document is it sets out crystal clear expectations as to how foster families can have confidence that the department will work with them. Open lines of communication, timely responses to queries, no fear of reprisal if they have concerns or grievances that they want to run up the leadership chain, involvement in the case planning for the children and their care, some pretty basic tenets that were pretty important to the foster families that I heard from and that the legislature has heard from in recent years, and wanted to set clear expectations for how staff at any level of our organization will interact with foster families. The two individuals I mentioned earlier, Monty Pro and Gene Fisher, are actually out in the field today training some of our frontline staff on that Foster Bill of Rights, which takes effect on August 1st, so that there's no misunderstandings anywhere in the department as to what our expectations are.
I want to switch gears for a minute now and talk a little bit about Medicaid, because some lawmakers in the Idaho legislature have expressed concern over the state's Medicaid budget, and they would like to find ways to slow the budget's growth. And former Director Dave Jeppesen said that he was working to reduce costs. Now, we should note the department spent much of last year reevaluating Medicaid rolls as part of a nationwide unwinding after the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I believe Health and Welfare pulled close to 185,000 people off of the Medicaid rolls here in Idaho. And now we have a large number of those who have re-enrolled or they have found other insurance. With all that being said, Director Adams, what will be your approach when it comes to Idaho's Medicaid program? And what plans do you have for the future of the program?
Well, I think a lot of what I've got planned is transparency and accountability. So next week, we're going to put out our first monthly report on Medicaid, and we'll put out a new report on the 15th business day of each month that talks about what the forecasted Medicaid expenditures were relative to the actual Medicaid expenditures. The goal is to provide monthly transparency to the legislature of how we're performing relative to forecast. But one of the things that I think is important for anyone listening to know is Medicaid is unique in the state budget. Medicaid and public education are the two that are open-ended budget items, so to speak. Anyone that shows up that is eligible for Medicaid, the state has a legal mandate to enroll them in Medicaid and cover their eligible medical expenses. So if more people qualify for Medicaid than had been forecasted, there's a state obligation to cover them. So enrollment is certainly one of the drivers. Medical inflation is one of the drivers. But one of the largest drivers in recent years of the Medicaid budget growth is the federal matching percentage. And, Medicaid's a complex state-federal partnership. But in, the simplest terms, the better a state does economically, the less the federal government will cover of your Medicaid expenses. And why that's important is Idaho has been one of the fastest growing states and has the fastest personal income growth of any state in the country. And what that means is people's wages are going up. Your take-home pay is generally going up higher than your counterparts in other states in the country. So as our personal income goes up, our economy is doing better relative to other states. Therefore, the amount that the federal government covers goes down. So this upcoming legislative session that we're going to have in January, right now the estimate is that the feds are going to stick Idaho with a $70 million tab that they would have otherwise covered if our state did not do as well economically. So in many ways, we're victims of our own success. And a lot of what I see my job is doing is bringing a dose of transparency, accountability, and then making sure the legislature knows what levers can be pulled and what is out of our control. Looking in the crystal ball for the upcoming legislative session, I wouldn't anticipate the department leading out on a lot of Medicaid initiatives. I wouldn't anticipate, the department proposing expansions or anything like that. My focus is on child welfare, and certainly there's a nexus with Medicaid, behavioral health services, but we just went live with the largest expansion of behavioral health in the history of the state. We went live with a new behavioral health managed care contract on July 1, provides access to new services, it provides wraparound supports, it provides integrated coverage in a way that we haven't had before. We really think that's going to lead to better behavioral health outcomes and better access to care for behavioral health than we've ever had. And implementing that with fidelity is going to be our focus because of its nexus with child welfare outcomes. But this upcoming session, our laser focus is going to be on child welfare. We need to increase rates that we pay to foster families to get more through the door. We need more caseworkers to bring caseloads down so that we can communicate and work with foster families in a manner that they deserve and have asked for. We need more folks focused on prevention so that we can prevent kids coming into the system, but do so in a safe manner where the family gets access to the services, the counseling, or the treatment they need. I've been pretty clear with both the governor's office as well as the legislature that I will be coming with a request for child welfare, but we will be able to have a narrative of what outcomes we're buying for that investment and what we can expect. And that's where my focus is going to be this upcoming legislative session.
So one of your past jobs was executive director of the Idaho State Board of Pharmacy. And my understanding, director, is that you gained a bit of a reputation there for cutting red tape. So I'm curious, is that a goal at health and welfare?
Well, certainly a safe bet that that's a goal at health and welfare. You know, one of the things I did, this is the third director job I've had. And certainly one of the things you do as you prepare is you need to understand what the statutes and regulations are that are expected of your agency. And, you know, put that together coming in, I found we have 897 pages of statute related to the department and 1,370 pages of regulation. So anyone that knows me knows that that probably caused me some degree of anxiety. And certainly it's regulatory rainforest that I intend to cut through. So one of the first activities I had my leadership team do was each of those pages of statute, we assigned it to one of the divisions, public health or behavioral health or Medicaid, and asked them, is this still needed or is it not needed? And we found a lot that were not needed. Committees that have not met since the Lyndon Johnson administration, grant programs that haven't been funded since the 1980s. And you're going to see us bring a bill to the legislature this upcoming session that repeals more than 100 sections of just obsolete sections of code, zombie programs, I would call them, programs that no longer exist, no longer meet, or are no longer funded. And you're going to see us do the same with regulations. We're having a lot of conversations about, regulations that haven't been updated since the 80s, for example, and do we still need them? And if there is a compelling public health or safety argument for them, we're going to keep them. We're going to modernize them. We're going to update them. But otherwise, we're going to put them in the dustbin of history. A lot of what I want to do is get that number of regulations and statutes down because, frankly, it's untenable. I mean, there were 694 references to the director of health and welfare, what the director should do or shouldn't do. And that's, that's a volume that no person is credibly able to manage. And that's something I want to be as known by what we stop doing as what we start doing. So I've asked all my leadership team to create stop doing list. I do recognize the contradiction of that, but clearing away the regulatory rainforest, clearing away the brush, simplifying and streamlining the department is a pretty keen priority of mine. Yeah. But for the betterment of the public that we serve.
So, before you stepped into the role of director, and I'm sure you're aware of this, health and welfare went through an audit by the Legislative Services Audits Division that revolved around the Community Partner Grant Program. Some lawmakers were not happy with that program. So how will you be working to heal relationships within the Idaho legislature and even the community, frankly, and try to move past any of that, antagonism that might still be there?
Yeah, certainly. I guess I would say generally, my approach to being a new director at any agency, this one included, is, we're only going to look at what's in front of us. We're not going to dwell on what's in the rearview mirror. We're going to learn from it, but we're going to keep driving forward to make the best decisions moving forward. So as I drive forward, the core tenets I've outlined is maximizing transparency. I've never seen a government program fail for being too transparent. Certainly to the contrary, I've seen a commitment to transparency and accountability strengthen an agency standings in the eyes of the public and help them achieve even more. So I talked earlier about the Medicaid transparency report I'm doing. I'm going to do a similar one on our self-reliance programs. And, I've tried to be in constant touch with our legislature. I've sent a fair number of emails to members of our Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, just detailing some of the steps I'm taking, as well as the germane policy committees of jurisdiction, the health and welfare committees in both the House and the Senate. One of the things that I've been talking to the team about doing upcoming, and at risk of breaking some news that we're going to announce later this week, we've talked about creating an Office of Program Integrity, as well as a transparency team, to better shepherd public records requests, both for the media as well as any interested member of the public. And then the Office of Program Integrity would help any of our programs throughout the department with training and other things to prevent compliance issues, but also allow us to look under the hood and identify issues and resolve issues before they metastasize to legislative issues. So a lot of how we're setting up the internal structure is focused on transparency and accountability in a way that I think will address many of the root issues of the concern. The grant program that you mentioned relates to child care. Specifically, child care is an area that's of deep personal interest to me. I do have a five-year-old daughter of my own and can attest, even as a director of an agency, finding child care, access to child care, and the cost of child care is difficult for many throughout our state. And it really does have an impact on workforce development. So child care is an area that I want to focus on heavily. I want to bring more resources to it. So I've tasked the team to work with our State Department of Education to see what dollars we might be able to leverage as match to draw down additional federal funds to bring additional funds to child care subsidies for families in need across the state. A couple other things I've done on child care. I did waive the fee for small daycare facilities. So we're a state that has in-home daycares if you have six or fewer children. And I waive the licensing fee for those to send a message that we want to be as easy and accessible as possible for new mom and pop daycares to open throughout our state. And then lastly, we did have as a state a tighter child to staff ratio than other states. And, you know, certainly as a parent, the child to staff ratio is something that's really important to me. You kind of look at it as a barometer of quality. However, if you tighten the screws too tight on that, it can make access more difficult. So I did up the ratio for non-infants. So to be crystal clear, anyone under the age of two, it will have no impact on the ratio. But for those above the age of two, I changed it. I basically added one to the ratio. Studies demonstrated that that's there hasn't been studies to demonstrate that that would be less safe. And by loosening that ratio in compliance with what other states have done, that does add 600 to 700 seats to our daycares across the state if every daycare opted into that plus one regulation change. So just a couple areas of moving forward, how I'm going to focus on child care, but listeners can rest assured as a dad of a young child who's been in these facilities the last couple of years, increasing access, increasing affordability is something I'm going to focus on.
Well, I have to say I appreciate that, having been through that whole process, having young kids at one point and trying to find good quality care even before the pandemic was difficult. So good. I'm sure a lot of listeners will be happy to hear about that. Director Adams, we asked listeners to send in some questions and we got a couple. So I want to start with Brittany because she says she wants to know if it's true that you are bringing all remote employees back to the office. And if so, why?
I would not characterize that as true. There was quite a bit of discussion with the legislature earlier this year about statewide telework policies, and they introduced a bill that would have set some standards that agencies had to meet. In lieu of that, the State Division of Human Resources adopted a new statewide policy that limits to a certain percentage the number of workers in any organization that could work remotely. It's predicated on the belief from the legislature and others that what happens in an office matters, that those water cooler conversations matter, that the intangibles of having folks working together, collaborating, and working synergistically matters. So that process started during the legislature this year, and my predecessor was the one who had to implement that statewide policy and bring folks back to the office. I'm taking, you know, a nuanced approach. We'll fulfill the state HR policy, but I personally am generally supportive of remote work for positions that have metrics associated with them and it can quantify the output and have quality assurance. So we will continue to have a hybrid schedule where, you know, the portion of our employees work remotely and we'll be fulfilling the expectations of the legislature and the state HR policy in so doing.
So health and welfare has weathered some hot button issues over the past few years, including pulling the department sponsorship from the 2022 Boise Pride Festival. So Caitlin asks, how does the department support LGBTQIA folks here in Idaho?
I think the goal of the department is to help all Idahoans, regardless of background. And that's one of the great things about the department is how many lives we touch. Yeah, I think if you add up all of our programs together, you know, between SNAP and TANF and, you know, the Medicaid program and others, a quarter of all Idahoans have an interface with the department. And my goal is to serve all Idahoans with respect and with compassion and help them achieve long-term self-reliance and self-sufficiency.
So another listener writes in and he says, hi, Idaho Matters and Director Adams. I am a family member of someone who passed away from an overdose in North Idaho recently. What is health and welfare's and the state's plan for combating addiction, drug abuse, and overdose deaths?
Well, certainly my condolences to the family. I know it's never easy, but I appreciate the vulnerability and the candor in sharing their story and looking to make a difference by hopefully working with us and others. There's a couple things I would really focus on. Certainly one of the things that can prevent overdoses is naloxone. It's an overdose reversal agent. And the department has worked with Kootenai County as kind of a distributor statewide to get naloxone out into all of our communities. So I would encourage anyone listening who knows somebody at risk or might yourself be at risk, certainly reach out about availability of naloxone. It's something that can be obtained cheaply or free in some instances and really can save a life. So having some on your person, carrying it in your purse, having one in your car is probably a good risk mitigation strategy. My background is pharmacy, so you might imagine, you know, I've been looking at the opioid and substance use disorder issues for quite some time in different roles, and has watched how the pendulum has swung back and forth. But folks can rest assured, one of the things that I tend to focus on is increasing capacity of treatment in the community. And I know there was a grant passed by the legislature to fund more healthcare practitioners in our state getting credentialed to prescribe medication-assisted treatment. And medication-assisted treatment is something that can help wean an individual off of an opioid addiction and help with the symptoms and the cravings that often come with weaning off. And I think the grant will provide funding for up to 300 individuals in our state, pharmacists, psychologists, nurse practitioners, or PAs, to go through the training and to obtain the credentialing necessary under both state and federal law to prescribe medication-assisted treatment. And certainly hope that that will increase access to these services in rural communities so that folks can access these in their backyard.
Can you talk a little bit about your, I believe this is a new plan, the Idaho Behavioral Health Plan.
It is. It went live on July 1st with a new vendor, and it really brings together services and coordinates services in a way that hasn't happened in the past. And it's really designed to have a team of experts help identify the right setting in the least restrictive environments in which care can meet a family's needs. And certainly excited about it. You know, anytime you go live with something, there's always a host of implementation issues. So far, I would say there's been speed bumps, but no major curbs that we've hopped. Mm-hmm. And certainly would encourage folks who have those in need or are themselves in need to take advantage of these services. If you're a Medicaid beneficiary, certainly reach out to the department, and happy to speak more about the services that are available to you and how to access those services.
Investigate West published a story this month about kids on Medicaid here in Idaho who need the, quote, highest level of psychiatric treatment available, unquote, but are often denied psychiatric residential treatment. You know, some of these kids, they are aggressive. They're even violent, and their parents cannot safely care for them, and their doctors say they need institutional care. Your department has said removing these children from their homes is a last resort, and that that taking them out of the home is extreme and traumatizing. So with that said, Director, how can you help these children and their families stay safe while getting the treatment that they need? And I should note, I think it's really important to note that Idaho is not alone in this issue. This is a problem that so many states are facing.
You certainly hit the nail on the head that access is critical and necessary. My focus on child welfare certainly encompasses this topic. And, you know, for anyone facing these challenges, these are highly complex cases, and finding solutions to help children and families is going to be my priority. And fundamentally, for any mental health service, it should occur generally in the least restrictive environment while meeting the child's needs. And as you said, taking a child away from a loving family and admitting that child to a residential treatment facility can cause trauma and even regression for the child. So, as you know, medical experts do not always agree on what level of care should be provided when disagreement occurs. Our focus will always be on the best interest of the child. I did talk a little bit about the new behavioral health plan that went live that will grow service capacity across the state. And just know that it's an area that I'm going to be focusing on. Recently, I've had the opportunity to meet with a couple parents in this space. And, you know, I've told them I admire their passion because they're fighting for their children. They're fighting to get them the right care at the right setting at the right time. And as a parent myself, I admire that and want to be part of the fight for them and with them to get the kid the right services.
Director, one of your first steps after taking office was to eliminate, I believe, about 170 vacant positions, as well as four committees, and you called them obsolete. So Sharon wrote in saying, who got cut and why cut them as opposed to filling them?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. They were vacant positions. They existed only on paper. So oftentimes what agencies do is they'll over-establish positions so that they can post them and hire more quickly. Over time, a lot of agencies have radically over-established positions beyond, you know, a credible benchmark. So I tasked each of our divisions with limiting their over-established positions to just 10% of their allowable number of positions. And that's what kicked 170 out of the system. Why that was important to me is we need to right size the number of positions we have, because when we went to the legislature, it would have appeared that there are 170 vacancies that did not exist. There was no funding for those positions, and we had no capacity to fill those positions. However, once it looks like there's 170 positions open, it limits my ability to go to the legislature with a request like I intend to this next session. As I already said, child welfare is going to be my priority. We need more caseworkers so I can get caseload down. We need more folks to focus on prevention so that we can keep children out of the system, keep children safe. And what I want to do is be able to have an honest conversation with the legislature about how many positions we have open relative to what our needs are, so that we can be successful in righting the ship on child welfare.
So Sharon also asked, quote, since agencies must go before JFAC in order to get approval to add staff, is there also a review or approval process in order to cut staff? If so, are the director's cuts proposed pending review rather than actual?
So as I mentioned, these were, you know, paper positions that didn't exist. We've eliminated them from the system. In general, you know, the way the budget laws of the state are set up, it's designed to prevent an agency from outspending its appropriation. I'm not generally aware of anything that would prevent an agency from underspending its appropriation. Statewide, in general, agencies would revert about $10 million in unused funds at the end of the year. And the Department of Health and Welfare was actually reverting some unused Medicaid dollars at the end of this year, as I understand it. So it's not uncommon for agencies to underspend their budget. That's frankly good government. You know, unlike DC, We have a balanced budget requirement, and generally agencies live within their means.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised when you took the position to find out that you had 170 vacant positions? I'm not a director of anything, but that seems like a lot of positions.
Well, you know, percentage-wise, health and welfare's vacancies probably weren't different than any other agency, and overestablished positions were probably no different than any other agency. The difference we're dealing with is scale. We are the largest agency in the state. As I said, 3,000 folks. No other agency comes close to that. So the largest agency by staff and by budget, and trying to bring a hyper-focus to it also requires us to make decisions that demonstrate to the legislature. We've heard the totality of the messaging from them lately. We're demonstrating transparency. We're demonstrating accountability. So that when we come in this next session in January with a request, frankly, a major request, for child welfare, they take it seriously and they know that we're a team that they can bet on and that they'll get a return on investment out of.
Director Adams, you mentioned earlier that one quarter of all Idahoans interface in some way with health and welfare. That's a pretty incredible number. So what brings most people in contact with your department? I mean, is it a crisis or is it, I mean, what is it exactly?
Well, certainly people turn to the department often in the most vulnerable times of their lives. You know, the things that have the highest volume of use, Medicaid enrollment, SNAP enrollment, many people know that as food stamps, and then involvement with the child welfare foster care system. So oftentimes we're there at the most vulnerable times of people's lives, and you know, our goal isn't necessarily to interface with a quarter of the population. Our goal is to provide some of that spring in the safety net so that they can be self-reliant and not need the department moving forward.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, is you know, when there is then criticism, maybe about how big the department is, or, you know, when there are questions about the certain needs of the department, and when we look at that number of a quarter of Idahoans who interface with the department, I mean, can there be an argument made there that says, look, as you said, you don't necessarily want to have everyone, you know, so many people interface with health and welfare, but you are necessary at very vulnerable times of people's lives. So does that ever come up when there are discussions, when people are questioning the department?
Well, you know, one of the challenges with the department, as I've said, is just the sheer size. So many different folks interface with it at many different angles, and there's just so many different programs. I mean, you know, how many people listening know that the department has programs to help people with car repairs, with job training, and other things like that? And there's a whole host of welfare programs that are on, as you know, others have aptly pointed out, the most successful long-term welfare program there is a job and steady employment. So a lot of what I'm doing is to ensure that we're the spring in the safety net, to help people transition back to self-sufficiency, to help people work and be successful, to help people, you know, get married and have families and get the education they need so that they aren't reliant on the services that the department provides. Mm-hmm. That said, it is important to have a strong safety net, but there to be spring in that safety net.
You know, earlier in the program, we touched on the growing Medicaid budget, and part of that comes from the increasing costs of healthcare. How are you planning to keep the budget under control when a lot of these costs are frankly beyond your control?
Well, certainly there's a lot that's beyond our control, and there is that some that is in our control. So we are having those conversations about what is in our control, what levers can be pulled, and how hard do you pull those levers. You know, a couple of the things we've talked about is as part of our transparency reports monthly, there's optional services that we provide and there's mandatory services that we provide, and breaking out the dollar amounts by each of those categories so that folks know that. There's also, you know, things that you can do to deter misutilization of services or redirect people from incorrect venues of care to more appropriate venues of care. If you have a basic cold, if you have a cold sore, the emergency room probably isn't the place for you. How do we disincentivize care in those settings for the wrong things and redirect them to pharmacies or to primary care offices where appropriate. So we're going to be looking at all of those things. As I said, though, in the short term, my hyper focus is going to be on child welfare. And that's where I'm going to spend the disproportionate time and energy, especially heading into this next legislative session.
So how will you go about doing that within the legislative session when it comes to child welfare, making that, as you said on day one, a top priority? And we should note that includes adoption, foster care. I mean, you know, the whole of child welfare.
Certainly. Well, we're gearing up for a budget request. Budget submissions are due to the governor's office and the legislature on September 1. So buckle up. You'll see our request sooner rather than later, but it's many of the concepts I previewed here today. Beyond that, you're going to see us spending quite a bit of time with our counterparts in the legislature between now and the end of the year to make sure they understand the problem that we're trying to solve and why we're the right team to solve this. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, Medicaid and education being unique in that there's they're somewhat open-ended and there's a state obligation to cover everybody that's qualified and shows up. Child welfare is the same. If the number of children go up that are committed to the care of the department, we have a legal obligation to place them and find a stable placement for them. And, you know, I inherited a $24 million budget deficit because the number of kids in our care, the complex conditions that they had, and the overuse of congregate care settings for them strained our budget. So, you know, you could either invest in prevention or you can invest in the downstream cure. A lot of what we're going to be asking for with the legislature this up year is on the prevention side. But to do so, it's going to take holding other budgets flat. It's going to mean we're not asking for expansion of Medicaid services or other things like that, because our short-term focus and our biggest ROI is going to be on child welfare.
So I have less than 2 minutes left with you. So very quickly, as we wrap up, what has been the biggest challenge, but also maybe maybe not the easiest part of the new job, but maybe the most rewarding so far?
Well, certainly I'll start with the latter. The most rewarding is signing adoption consents. I signed five yesterday, like previous directors. I read every word and every page of those adoption consents. And I want us, you know, I heard someone say, you know, the department doesn't want to be an adoption agency. Well, I do. I want to be an adoption agency. I want to make it as easy as possible. I want permanency. I want these kids to have a stable, loving family in their lives. So the most rewarding is certainly signing the adoption consents. And I'm going to do everything I can to incentivize adoption and reduce friction to adoption. You know, the toughest is just the sheer size of the organization. Every day I'm bringing in a new team and learning a new program, and some of them make me scratch my head, and some of the programs like, why are we still doing that? You know, but you know, everything is an exercise in triage. Even though there's a lot of areas I could engage or want to engage, I don't want to lose focus of adoption, foster care, child welfare, improving permanency, improving our relationships with foster families. These folks are heroes. They're making an impact that will last generations and break the cycle of poverty of folks coming to the department. And that's where I want to spend my time and energy.
Yeah, well, we definitely all have an obligation to take care of the children of Idaho. So thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate you taking the full hour with us to talk with us about these issues.
Certainly. Thank you, and happy to come back anytime.
Well, we appreciate that. We've been talking with Alex Adams. He is the new director of the Idaho Health and Welfare Department. We've been talking about his plans for the future of the department, as well as some of the challenges and obstacles that he has faced in the first 5 weeks on the job. And I want to thank all of our listeners who sent in questions for Director Adams as well. We always love your participation, so thank you as well. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.